For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
So we left off, the flood happened. You know, there's Noah and the flood. Things in the world had gotten so bad, it said that evil was on people's mind continually. That's what it says in Genesis 6:5. And the earth and the world was so depraved that God wiped everybody out in a flood. Everybody except Noah and his family. And so we're going to kind of look at the post-flood aftermath over these next few chapters that we're going to study. We're going to say just a teeny bit about Genesis 9 and 10. Not much. But then we're going to really camp out in Genesis 11. And I think it's just a powerful story. I hope you get as much out of it as I did as I was prepping for it. Now in Genesis 9, so Noah comes out of the ark. The earth's drying up. And we read that God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth." Now, if you've been tracking with me as we've gone through Genesis, you've heard this command before. This is what God told Adam and Eve. He told them, "I want you to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth." This has been God's intent from all along, to see every corner of the earth filled with human beings scattered everywhere enjoying his creation. That's what he wants. But as you see, as we go on, it may not exactly work out that way. The other thing that's significant in this chapter is God comes to Noah and says, "I'm going to remember my covenant with you and with all living creatures. Never again will the flood waters destroy all life." And so God promises, "I'm not going to do, destruction by flood ever again." And so in a lot of ways, this is a fresh start. This is a new beginning. And in some ways, Noah is kind of a new Adam, you know, the source of a new humanity. And the big question hanging out over all of this is, what trajectory are humans going to pursue? What path are they going to follow? What's going to happen? How are things going to spin out now that they've gone through this horrible experience of this judgment in the flood? Now, early signs are not promising. If you read in chapter 9, it says that Noah promptly gets drunk, strips naked, and passes out. And I'm not exaggerating. That's exactly what it says. So there's some dysfunction. And that dysfunction only gets uglier as you read on in the chapter. We're not going to get into the morbid details. But early signs are that despite the tremendous setback of the flood, despite seeing God move in judgment against sin, it looks like humanity is going to barrel right down the same path again. Now, in Genesis 10, what we get is a table of nations. This is an unparalleled document in all of ancient literature. There's nothing like it. It's fascinating. It studies basically how human beings, Noah's descendants, moved out and basically did what God wanted. Went to every corner of the globe, diverse locations, in diverse cultures, speaking a variety of languages. That's what Genesis describes, Genesis 10. Like I said, this is what God was wanting for humanity, was for them to spread out and fill the earth and multiply. And by the end of chapter 10, that's exactly what we read about. Now, when we get to 11, which is where we're going to really camp out, we're at the Tower of Babel, a famous story, a story a lot of us are familiar with. And in this story, it starts out saying that the whole earth used the same language and the same words, which is strange. I mean, the same language, they're in the same location. I thought we just read in Genesis 10 that they spread out everywhere into different places and different cultures speaking different languages. So what's happening here? Well, I think this is an example of, this is a place in Genesis where there's some topical arrangement. And so what we have in chapter 10 is God describing how those nations were dispersed, how they came to be in different places, speaking different languages. In chapter 11, we're learning about why it happened. What was the impetus that led to humanity spreading out as God desired? So that's what we're going to get into. Now, it says in verse 2, it came about as they journeyed east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. And this isn't like, in a galaxy far, far away. It's not that type of language. We know where the land of Shinar is. It's in Mesopotamia, that green spot in the middle of the map there. You read commentators, secular, Christian, whatever, they agree that this, the land of Shinar, is what we would call modern-day Iraq. It's the cradle of civilization. This is the area, this is a real place on the earth where these events unfold. Now it says, these people said to one another, come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly. And they used brick for stone and used tar for mortar. They said, come, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower whose top will reach into heaven. And let us make for ourselves a name, otherwise we'll be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth. Now, this idea of like building a tall tower made out of bricks, glued together with tar, some people say bitumen, that's a common thing in this part of the world. You could go take a shovel, go out to Mesopotamia, and you would find the ruins, the foundations, and in some places, the still standing structures and footers connected to these tall towers. Even some of the details in here, like baked bricks and tar for mortar. We found actual physical structures in this part of the world that perfectly match that description. The word ziggurat, probably heard that word before. It's an Akkadian word. It means to build high, and that's likely what we're reading about here, some kind of enormous ziggurat. Now, no one's sure where this might be. There's different theories. There are some enormous structures that we found the foundations of. But this is plausible when you think about just the setting and how this is described. This is the kind of thing that people were doing in this region of the world. Now, what was it they were trying to accomplish? Well, it's funny. You read people speculating about this. There's all these different crazy ideas, like what's similar to Stonehenge or astrology or whatever. And maybe, but I think it's right here. What were they trying to accomplish? They were trying to make a name for themselves. In their own words, they were trying to make a name for themselves. They wanted to build a structure that would elevate them up into the heavens, to put them on the same par with God. This was a self-deification project. A lot of these ancient ziggurats would be painted with this like blue enamel so it would blend in with the sky. It was the idea of wanting to rub shoulders with deity. It wasn't about submitting to God, respecting God, and following God. It was vaunting self over and above God. That's what this whole project was about. It was a project in self-glorification. The concept here of tower building, you go on and read in the Bible, and these kind of lofty structures are associated with human pride and self-assertion. You can read those references sometime. You can see other kings of not Babel, but Babylon, kings that ruled this same region with this same dark heart of pride. Here's Nebuchadnezzar as he reviews his building projects. He says, look at this great city of Babylon, my own mighty power. By my own mighty power, I built this beautiful city as my royal residence to display my majestic splendor. that is really over the top. But that's what we're reading about, is this kind of self-exalting, self-promoting, self-deifying project. That's part of what they were trying to accomplish. The other thing, and this is a real smoking gun revealing their attitude, is they were trying to avoid being scattered abroad over the face of the earth. Now remember, in Genesis 9, God said, I want you to multiply and fill the earth. That was God's clearly stated will. And just like Cain before them, if you remember from our teaching on Cain, they concentrated in one place, and they, instead of scattering, they built a city. This was brazen defiance. You guys ever tried to deal with a defiant toddler? You know, you're like, how about you put the toy away? How about I throw it across the room? Or how about you put that spoonful of yogurt in your mouth? Well, now I think I'm going to smear it in my hair. I think that's what I'm going to do. That type of defiance is exactly what we're looking at here. Just a big talk to the hand to God. Very, very defiant. So what's God's response? I mean, he could do a reset and just wipe them out with a flood, but he said he wouldn't. So what's his response going to be? Well, if you read on, it says, the Lord came down to see the city. And that's right there, that thought. Let's just think about that for a second. They're like brick upon brick, level upon level, trying to reach the way up to God to be in this kind of heavenly stratosphere. But God's like, no, I'm going to have to come down to you. That's the only way we're going to interact. It's me coming down to your level. And it goes on and it says, he came down to see the city and the tower that the people were building. The Lord said, if as one people speaking the same language they've begun to do this, then nothing they plan to do will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and confuse their language so that they will not understand each other. So, you know, you're working on the wall or on this tower, laying a brick, and you're like, you tell somebody, hey, could you hand me that trowel? And they're like, parlez-vous français? And all of a sudden, you know, you can't communicate. You're like, all of a sudden, maybe they had a lingua franca. Maybe they had their different dialects, but they could all speak in a shared language. That ability was gone. And so their ability to continue this construction project ended. And they wound up being scattered all over the place. Now, what is it that God so hacked off about? I was thinking about, you know, if we saw something like this, humanity coming together in unison, trying to do something great, how would we feel about that? I think we'd be excited to see that. Finally, people working together, unified, doing something. I think we'd be really encouraged to see that. But God is not encouraged. God is very concerned. God's so concerned, he says, nothing they plan to do is going to be impossible for them. He realizes, you know, God can see the future. He can project out what's going on. And he can tell if this spins out, this act of rebellion and defiance, it's going to boil over into the same situation we had before the flood. And he's right. This theme, when you think about this in the Bible, just the imagery of it, building this tower in defiance of God, it's an archetype, what theologians call a type. It's a symbol of something that recurs again and again and again, brazen human pride raised up against God. We see this not just here in Babel, like I mentioned. We see it when Babel becomes Babylon. We see it when God taunts one of the future kings of Babylon. He says, you said in your heart, I'll ascend to heaven. I'll raise my throne above the stars of God. I'll ascend above the heights of the clouds. I'll make myself like the Most High. And this chapter goes on, and God's like, no, you won't. You know, and not just here, we see in human history. We see tyrants rising up, trying to unify humanity under their rule. We see the Caesars. We see guys like Napoleon, like Hitler, trying to amass power and to bring everybody under one rule, one human enterprise. We see that again and again. At the end of the Bible, we see something called Babylon the Great. We have to realize, you know, we're not super creative people. Most of what we come up with, we got from somewhere else. And this kind of self-promoting pride, is that just something humans invented? No. We got that from the original author. We got it from Satan himself. Satan is the original rebel. Satan is the guy who wanted to equate himself with God. And it's his heart, his values, his outlook that has been energizing humanity to have this independent sense of culture, religion, economics, you name it, apart from God. And the Bible says one day at the end of history, humanity, led by a dictator that the Bible calls the Antichrist, he's called the man of lawlessness, the beast. He's a future human leader who will rule the world, who will be energized by Satan's values, and it will explode in rebellion in something Revelation calls Babylon the Great. You can read about it in Revelation 17 and 18. This is this is just on the porch of the end of history. And God sees all this as he sees the historic construction of the Tower of Babel. He projects into the future and he's like, we're heading there way too fast. And so out of mercy, and because he values diversity, values, you know, think about the end of the Summer Olympics where they have the nations parading around. Because God has those values and doesn't want to see the pot of rebellion just boil over like a pot on the stove, he turns the burner down. That's what we're reading about here. It's God just going from 8 to 2 on that burner just so it doesn't boil over. And so he scatters them. It says he scatters them from there all over the earth. You can read, if you look carefully, in Genesis 10, this happened during the life of Peleg. Genesis 10, verse 25, says it was in his generation, he's one of the descendants of Noah, that the world divided. Okay, so that they stopped building the city. That's why it was called Babel. Because there the Lord confused the language of the whole world. From there the Lord scattered them over the face of the whole earth. Babel. That's the Bible's term for this city. And there's a play on words here. And actually, the name Babylon comes from Babalu. That's an Akkadian word. It means gate of the gods. Babel is a Hebrew word. Sounds similar. It means confusion. It's God's like trying to build a tower, trying to elevate yourself on my level. You're confused. That project will never work. And so there you go. That's the story. That's what happens. That is the trajectory that humanity strikes out on after the flood. Real quickly, did it really happen? You know, we don't have any concrete evidence outside the Bible for this, but we have some interesting things to think about as far as the historicity of this event. One is that in the Bible, this is told as history. You know, as we go on and we read about Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and all these other historical figures, there's no change in the way this book is written. The narrative is very straightforward here, and it continues on. The author of Genesis meant this to be taken as history. It's absolutely clear. And there are some interesting things we have dug up in this area. This is Gleason Archer. Looks like the quintessential grandpa, but he PhD from Harvard, knows 12 ancient languages. This is, I'd say, we put a lot of different people up here when we do these teachings. This guy knows his stuff. He wrote a book, which is fantastic, called A Survey of Old Testament Introduction. And in that book, talking about the Tower of Babel, he mentions that they have discovered on a 10 by 5 foot stele, which is a standing stone with writing on it, that was erected by a Sumerian king named Ur-Nammu, they found this writing on there. The construction of this tower highly offended all the gods. In a night they threw down what man had built and impeded their progress. Again, this is not a biblical text. This is a Sumerian text. It says they were scattered abroad and their speech was strange. And so there is a memory or a story, not just in the Hebrew Bible, but in this region. And just like we saw with Noah and the flood 2 weeks ago, this story isn't just lingering here in this part of the world, but if you look at tribes in Mexico or in places as far away as Burma or the Congo, they have stories about these towers being built, about people being scattered and their language being confused. So there is some evidence that there may be, and we're not sure, it could be borrowing, but one plausible explanation is that these things we're finding are reflecting a shared memory of an actual event. So I don't think he can just sweep this aside. This can't be just dismissed as myth. So what are we supposed to learn from this? Well, this is what I want to spend the second half of our time on here. What a predictable response from God. They build this tower. They elevate themselves. It's basically an enterprise focused on pride. And what does God do? He ends it. You know, we're familiar with a lot of physical laws in the world, like gravity. If I drop this, if I stop supporting this, it will fall to the ground every time. It always works that way. And there are spiritual laws, too, that are just as predictable and that directly apply to pride and that are repeated throughout the Bible. And here's one of them. He who exalts himself will be humbled. There's no if. It may not be today or next week, but it will happen. God will bring low humans who are proud. He promises to do it. We have a lot of promises. This is a promise from God that you can bank on. Fortunately, there's a corollary to this law that kind of goes in the other direction, thankfully. And it's that he who humbles himself will be exalted. God promises if we come to him and humble ourselves before him, he will lift us up. And so we really have a fork in the road here. The same decision that early humans had, what are we going to do with God? Are we going to pridefully ignore him, pridefully strike out and do our own thing? Or are we going to submit to him and humble ourselves before him? Every human being has to make that choice for themselves. And so I want to spend some time thinking about humility. Humility is the antidote to pride. It's the thing that we need. And so we're going to talk about what it is, why it's better than pride, and how we develop it. So let's talk about what it isn't, actually, as we talk about what it is. That's probably the best way to start. I'm going to give you some things that humility isn't. Then we'll define what it is. One thing humility is not is talking poorly about yourself. You know, I don't know how that really good thing I just accomplished happened. I just was in the right place at the right time. I'm really terrible. I don't know what I'm doing. It happened. That sounds humble, but that's not humility. That's self-deprecating language. It's not necessarily wrong, but they're not the same thing. take like LeBron, okay? What if LeBron came to you and he was like, you know, I'm just the worst basketball player ever. I mean, part of the problem with self-deprecating language is it's often not true. Often people who are very good at things, truly outstanding at things, will act like they're not. Now, it may be that they're just honestly trying to be humble and they're not sure how to do it, and so they've just latched onto this method. But I suspect, I could be cynical, but I think I'm right about this, that because there's a social contract that obligates people to encourage you when you're beating yourself up, you know, because like if I say, oh, that was the worst teaching I ever gave, and this is a hypothetical story, not, oh, that was so bad. No, honey, no, it was really good. I really liked it. Is it possible that sometimes our self-deprecating language is a way to fish for and extract the compliments we're looking for? Not about humility at all, but actually about pride, right? So no, humility is not self-deprecating language. It's also not refusing to be out front. If you remember the story with Moses, God came to him and said, I want you to go to Pharaoh so that you can lead my people out of Egypt. This is what God wanted. He singled out Moses and said, you're my point man. You will lead this whole massive country of people away from Egypt and into the promised land. You're my guy. And some of us have had that sense where maybe somebody's come to us and pointed out that we could serve in a visible role. Maybe not leading, but in some other role. Maybe we've even sensed God nudging us. Hey, what about you stepping up and serving in this particular way? And a lot of times when that happens, we respond like Moses. Moses says, please, Lord, I've never been eloquent, neither recently nor in time past, nor since you've spoken to your servant. I'm slow of speech and slow of tongue. So he's like, I don't have the resume to do this. Now, it actually says, and it's kind of crazy that it's in there. This is a strange thing in the Bible, but it says that Moses was the most humble man on the earth. It's in Numbers. So is this what we're reading about here? Is this an example of Moses' humility? I don't think so. Is looking God in the eye, God in this case, who has promised to Moses, I'll be with you. I'll be with your mouth. I'll help you talk. I will help you. I'll give you all the bells and whistles you need to get this job done. Is looking God in the eye and saying, no, that's not going to be enough. Is that humility? Is telling God, look, I've thought this through. I know better than you do. There's no possible way you could use me. That doesn't sound like humility. That sounds a lot like pride. I think we've got to really think hard here. When we go to God and we tell him that the thing he's nudging us to do is beyond our ability and that there's no way we could do it, check yourself. That is not humility. This is Francois Fenelon, who wrote quite a bit about humility. See what you think of this. He says, humility involves an absolute abandonment to God without the slightest doubt that he'll do great things in us. That humility is like, it's not about me, it's about God. And if God's involved, anything's possible. God's able to take a stick or a stone or a broken individual like me and use me. And man, so for me to tell God I could never X, Y, or Z, find somebody else. It feels humble, but it's very prideful. All right, humility isn't being nice. If you grew up in church, you know all about being nice, right? Don't cuss. If you don't have anything nice to say, don't say it. Greet people. Be friendly. Stay positive. Those are the ways we've been taught. And I'm not saying that we should suddenly like switch a gear around here and be rude. I'm not advocating somebody walks in, the greeter's like, wow, you look like crap. You should take a shower more often, or, you know. We don't want that kind of culture around here. That would be really bad. But what's funny is when you look at mature people in the Bible, like Jesus, he was not nice. Maybe you would disagree with me, but I don't think Jesus was nice. He was loving. He was a servant. He actually said we can learn humility from him because he's a humble servant. But he also spoke the truth and made people uncomfortable. He was courageous. I don't know if I'd call that nice. He was willing to talk to powerful people and risk his own life. He was willing to endure rejection and have the very people who talked down to him be people that he died for. I don't know what I'd call it. It's not nice. What that is, that's loving. That's humility. But it's not being nice. Humility is not being nice. So it's not all that. Then what is it? The problem with this particular concept is there is no textbook definition in the Bible. It's just not in there. What we have to do is kind of look at what the Bible associates with humility and try to define it like that. And I've read different authors trying to define this. I think probably the best shot, the simplest, straightforward definition I've seen is Andrew Murray. He says, humility is acknowledging the truth of our position as creature and yielding to God his place. Now just think back to the story of Babel. This is what was missing. This, you're God, and we yield to you that role, and we're creatures before you. And you know, the crazy thing is about humility, about acknowledging that we're a creature, is as we wade into that, God is willing to give us every single thing that those builders were striving to construct. You know, they wanted a city, a tower. They wanted a place in the world to stand. But what does God tell us? He says, Jesus says, when I leave, I'll prepare a place for you. Or if you read in the book of Revelation, it says that God's building this city and it's going to come down and the gates are going to be open forever and we can go in and out and be in God's presence for an eternity. We have a place. You think about they wanted a home in the heavens. God's like, no, I loved you enough. I've come down from heaven to be with you. And then one day when you've passed away, I'll bring you back with me and we'll spend eternity in heaven. They wanted to make a name for themselves. And what does God say? If you look in Revelation, I think it's in chapter 2, verse 17, God promises to those who turn to him, he says, I'll give you a new name. And he even says in another place in the Old Testament, he says, oh, that name's so important to me. I'm going to write it on my hand. I'm going to engrave it on my palms. So a place, a heaven, a name, a meaningful name, all of that is available. But there's only one price you have to pay to experience it. And that price is humility. That's it. And that's the one price these guys and people throughout history have been unwilling to pay. And yet this is what God demands. All of that's yours. But we have to admit who is God and who is a creature. Let's think about this second question. What is it about humility that's better than pride? Why is it better than pride? Well, this is one reason. It's because when we're humble, we can experience soul rest. You're familiar with physical rest. I mean, a lot of us don't do manual labor, but like if you're Christmas shopping at Easton and you've been carrying stuff all day, this is the best analogy for like 21st century America. You're tired from walking and buying things. And so you find a bench and you rest. physical rest, right? Spiritual rest is it's a different thing. We have a lot of deep soul needs like meaning, purpose, significance, value, hope, love. And when we're in soul rest, we're sitting before God and we're receiving that from Him. That's the concept of soul rest. David describes it. He says, Lord, my heart's not too proud, nor my eyes haughty, nor do I go after great matters or things too difficult for me. Surely I've composed and quieted my soul like a weaned child rests against its mother. My soul is like a weaned child within me. O Israel, hope in the Lord from this time and forevermore. So think about that image. The Bible's so good at images. A baby having just breastfed, sated, content, warm, safe, with its mom. That's what we're talking about, where we just get still and just sit before God and realize this is the position, this is the relationship we have with Him. Francois Fenelon, that guy I quoted earlier, he says, true abandonment, humility, is a simple resting in the love of God as an infant lies in its mother's arms, like we read about. Abandonment consists not in doing great things for self to take delight in, but simply in embracing our weakness and infirmity. It's an abandonment. It is thus that abandonment is the source of true peace. So, like, when you're hanging out with the Lord and you're praying in the morning, and you're before God and you're just pausing, just being silent, just realizing I'm in the presence of my Father, I'm His child, He's got my future laid out, He's continually aware of what's happening, He's willing to empower and infuse me with His life and love, He can see what I'm going to face, and He will walk with me through it, where I just am who I am, and let Him be who He is. That kind of, something like that. Or when we feel slighted and taken for granted. You know, where we want to lash out, where we want to make a point, where we want to be vindicated. And instead we're, you know, this posture is, I have a name. I have a place. I have my future with God secure. I don't need to thrash around. I can sit here and receive. If you don't have humility, you never experience what I'm talking about. And I'm not saying you have to have it continually, but these are real experiences that happen in the life of healthy Christians, and the doorway is humility. Here's another one. It's better because it gives credit where credit is due. You guys know who this is? Anybody? It's Denzel Washington, one of my favorite actors. He's given a commencement speech in this slide here. And he went and spoke to all these students, and he was joking around with them about, oh, yeah, you guys, it was all up to you. That's why you're graduating. That's how he starts it out. Kind of a sarcastic, oh, yeah, you did it all by yourself. And then he admits, he's like, that's what I thought when I was young. I was starting to really make it as an actor. So he really, you know, his career has taken off. So he says, I talked to my mother. I said, Ma, did you think that this was going to happen? And these eyes I put in here are, I listened to the talk and transcribed it. This is him emphasizing. So I'm going to read it like he said it. He said, did you think this was going to happen, Mom? That I'd be so big? That I'd be able to take care of everybody? That I can do this? That I can do that? And she said, all right, stop it right there. Stop it right there. She said, if you only knew how many people have been praying for you, how many prayer groups she put together, how many times she saved my sorry behind. Oh, you did it all by yourself. That's his mom talking. I'll tell you what you can do by yourself. Go outside and get a mop and bucket and wash them windows. You do that by yourself, superstar. He did it way better than I can do it, but he went on to give credit for his career to God. Pretty powerful talk. Just type in 2015, type in the text in yellow on YouTube. You can listen to it. It's a pretty powerful talk. So, you accomplished some goal recently. You landed some job. You finished a degree. And there were some people that helped along the way, and you were at the right place in the right time. But after a lot of hard work and effort and late nights, you did it. Is that the story? That's not the half of it. The bigger picture is that you were born here. In a society where people aren't trying to live on $2 a day. Many of us had parents who were advocating for us. A parent, two parents, relatives. We had access to state funding, or we had access to world-class schools 5 blocks from our house. We had so many things that were handed to us. Things like living, being able to breathe and think. Now, I've spent a lot of time recently with folks that have diminished mental capacity. Boy, sobering. You're just like, Lord, thank you that I can form a sentence. It's nuts to think that that it's just a little bit of elbow grease and hard work and voila. That's not true. That's pride. That's what that is. That's not giving credit where credit is due. We got to just recognize if we want to get this right, we got to think about the answer to this question. Who recognizes you or regards you as superior? What do you have that you didn't receive? What do you have that you didn't receive? What's the implied answer here? Absolutely nothing. Nothing at all. And so, yeah, this is another key reason is there's a sanity to acknowledging via humility that other people made things possible. It's just sane. Okay, so how are we going to get this? Well, real quick, commitment to God isn't enough. You know, if you're like, okay, March 31st, whatever time, this is the day I lay aside pride for good. I'm going to move on from that. Yeah, good luck. I don't think that's how it's going to work. You know, one thing that's really striking about the disciples, if you read about them, is how committed they were. They were with Jesus everywhere they went. They left their jobs. They dropped everything to follow him. They were with him 24/7. They didn't have a home to live in. None of that. And you know, the other thing that's really striking about the disciples, if you skim through the Gospels, is how entirely lacking in humility they were. So here's something sobering. Committed Christians, people who are really all in, every chip on Jesus' square, can still be incredibly proud. You can be a very active Christian. We've got a lot of people here that love Jesus. It's still possible to be proud. This is Murray talking about the disciples. This is a deep statement, and he's right. He says, deeper down than all this, and the all this here is just all this commitment that they had. He says, there was a dark power of the existence and hideousness of which they were hardly conscious, which had to be slain and cast out before they could be witnesses of the power of Jesus to save. There was something darker swimming around in them. And so you realize, if we're going to get to humility, it's not going to be, I'm going to double up my fist and do it. It's going to be a miracle of God, right? The disciples were with Jesus all the time. They heard him teach. They watched him do miracles. They had their own feet washed by Jesus. and it still wasn't enough. So how are we not screwed, right? We really need God's help. This is, if this will happen in your life, it will be an absolute work of God, like any good thing that happens in our lives. And so what is it with us? I mean, try not being proud. It does rule us with crippling, terrible power. Why is that? Well, it's because we have a sin nature, a built-in tendency to sin that's standard equipment with every human. And as long as our sin nature is in charge, we will never be released from the grip of pride, period. And no amount of like will and effort on your part will ever fix that. You need the introduction of an outside source of life to get set free. You've got to have the Holy Spirit. And if you're a believer, the Bible teaches that Jesus, who was humble, is living in you and can give you his humility through the indwelling presence of the Holy Spirit. It's the Spirit of God who doesn't turn us into humble people, but who gives us Jesus' humility. He's the one who does it. So a couple thoughts on this. As we talk about this topic, this is a humble question, right? Are you convinced of the utter impossibility of you being humble on your own? Are you convinced that that's the case? You have to be. That's the beginning to making progress in this area. And what about this? You know, Jesus, I quoted Matthew 11:29. He says, learn from me. I'm humble. I'm a humble servant. Come learn from me. Jesus has extended the invitation to every person here to personally teach you humility. But do we want it? Have we ever said, God, okay, I'm not going to go off on some self-improvement project. I know I need humility. I can only get it from you. Please help me have it. You don't have because you don't ask. That's what James says. This is where we have to begin, is with a heart that wants to learn. Let's think about what we can learn from Christ. If you look in the Gospels, like if you were like, I'm going to read John in 10 minutes, and you just kind of flip through as fast as you could, Murray points out, you'll notice that Jesus unceasingly uses the words not and nothing. Check this out. This is striking if you just look at it real quickly. The Son can do nothing of himself. I can do nothing on my own initiative. I don't receive glory from men. I've come down from heaven not to do my will, but the will of him who sent me. My teaching is not mine. I have not come of myself. I do nothing on my own initiative. Not nothing, never, not me, all the Father, over and over and over again. That's how Jesus lived his life. And you look at this, is this self-deprecating language? I'm just a big zero. Is that what Jesus is saying? Jesus did not have an inferiority complex. He was not insecure. He wasn't worried about what people thought. There's none of that. Jesus was God, and he knew it. He said before Abraham was, I am. This is not a man that had insecurities. He was humble. And here's probably the best definition of it you'll ever get, right from the Bible. He says, have this attitude. And he's talking about humility. In yourselves, which was in Christ, who, although he existed in the form of God, didn't regard equality with God a thing to be grasped. He emptied himself. He took on the form of a bondservant. He was made in the likeness of men, found in appearance as a man, and he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. Here's a hard word about humility. Humility involves obedience. It involves setting aside my agenda and doing what God wants. And this is such a theme in Jesus' life. He acted under the Father's direction. He served in the Father's strength and for the Father's interests. That's how he operated. And so as you think about, what would Jesus do if he walked in this room? He'd be like, Father, I need your strength to serve these people. Father, guide me to show me what to do. Father, I want to represent your interests here. I'm not here to just do my own thing. I want to be your representative here. And that's humility in action. And that's what Jesus wants us to pursue as well. This whole thing that he modeled during his life, humility in action, is what he is steering us toward as well. Right? You look at, why does he say, apart from me, you can do nothing? Well, that sounds like the way he talked about the Father. He says, this is my commandment, that you love one another. You know, that was what his whole life was about. Now he's turning to you and me and saying, how about it? How about forgetting about yourself, taking care of yourself, and giving your life to serve other people? And I know that it's scary. You know, we flip out about this, and Jesus knows that it's scary. But Jesus is, he's wise. He's been to heaven and back. He knows his stuff. And he knows this is life. This is the best way to live. That's why he tells them in this same passage, I want my joy to be in you in full. I'm inviting you to this rich way of life. So yeah, that's humility. It's coming in situations like this, ready to represent God's interests, ready to do what he wants you to do. Okay, let's wrap up here. Am I willing to let God give me a name and a place? Man, let's think about that. Are you willing right now to tell God, okay, I'm not going to chart some future course that's going to result in a tower being built. I'm going to let you take me where you want. And I'll trust myself to you. If you think about humility, nothing in the Bible is associated with more positive outcomes than humility. Not just justification before God, but God giving strength and a listening ear to people. God showing his favor to people. God giving joy, wisdom, and honor. You want a good career path? That's it right there. And so you've just got to decide, do I really trust God or not? Am I gonna quit this project of doing this myself? I think that's his message. He's trying to say, I've got your back. I've got, you know, sit still. Sit before me and let me give you a name. You ever try to open packages? There's actually a technical term called wrap rage. These are these clamshell plastic things, you know, that encase things that you want to get. And they're impossible to open. I don't know who thought this was a good idea. Like, you get out a pair of scissors, and it's even hard to open with scissors. Then you can't totally open it, so you use your hands. Then you slice your hands open. And this, you know, this lady's about to, what you wind up doing is just throwing it across the room because it's impossible to open. And that's what we're like. We're fighting with people. We're in our relationships. We're at our workplace. We're in our families. We're just like, I want a tower. And that's our plan B, right? God's plan A. You just saw plan A. It's humility. We have plan B. You know what? There is no plan B. There's no plan B. There is no plan B. It's humility. And that's a key part of humility, is acknowledging, okay, I'm done with the self-promotion project. And of course, we got to ask for the grace to get there every day. All right, am I teachable? Here's another quick one too. You know, some of us, when we get corrected, we're teaching people to never do that again. We're not hearing what they're saying. We're telling them, if you ever have the audacity to do that again, you will be punished. And so you just got to realize, okay, if I'm going to operate that way, what's going to happen? Well, you're going to have blind spots. You're going to have destructive things happening in your life you have no clue are going on that other people see and that you don't, and that are going to really be destructive. If you want to see your blind spots, you have to have the humility to let people talk to you. All right, last thing here. Am I willing to stop working my way up to God and instead humbly receiving the gift of salvation? Some of us feel like when we hear about the gospel, the central message of Christianity, we feel like being right with God solely based on what Jesus did, just because he died, that's it? A lot of people say that's too easy. They call it cheap grace. And let me just ask you, if you're here and you've been weighing this out and you're really tripped up over how easy it is, if it's so easy, why not do it? And why is it hard to put our faith in what Christ has done? Is it the intellectual obstacle? There's a lot of answers that the Bible gives us. And the evidences that support Christianity. Is it factual? Is that the problem? I think most people are conversant with the fact that they're sinful, that they need to be forgiven. I think they have that deep down sense, I know I've screwed up. Isn't it true that for many of us, the obstacle was pride? That's what it was. You know, you look at these verses that talk about how to get right with God. It talks how we're justified as a gift. That's a handout. And not just a gift, it's a gift by his grace. That's an undeserved handout. And anyone who's not willing to receive a handout like this from God will never know him. Because to benefit from what Jesus did, we have to have the humility to admit we need it. And I would just urge you, don't let this be an obstacle. If all your questions are answered, don't let the ease of salvation be an obstacle. Admit to yourself it's not that easy and humbly receive it. Okay, here's a homework assignment. How about this? Two great books on humility. The one on the left is just, it's dynamite. It's more theological. The one on the right is very practical. And there you go. There's some thoughts. All right, Lord, we're... what a work in progress. This is a deep-seated issue we're looking at. It's not just a historical artifact. We see this pride in our own hearts every day. And we do just thank you for the grace you've shown us and every good reason you've given us to choose your plan A. Lord, just give us the strength and direction to live the humble lifestyle that you want us to pursue, God.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.